I'm not a researcher. My background is as a composer and a musician, which raises the question of why make instruments at all. And I think of it as a question of the angst of the post-Cagean luthier. Which is that Cage opened up a whole can of worms. And I think that in the aftermath of studying with Cage and his followers, I sought to make instruments that kind of balance determinacy and indeterminacy in their operation in an interesting way and in a way that was different from available systems.
Nicholas Collins is a music maker and avant-garde composer with an aesthetic that harks back to Western music's early days, when instruments were essentially handmade and non-standard, as they still are in some folk communities today. This idea of making your own sound device came into its own again in the 20th century as experimentation in new music collided with the age of electronics and the easy access to new technologies that could be altered and rewired to produce new sound possibilities. As Nicholas Collins put it so poetically, he suffered from the angst of the post-Cagean luthier. Born in a technological age and wanting to explore the potential of the devices at hand. So he adapted early computer technology and electronic devices, often mounting them on traditional instruments, and then went on to use these unique instruments in live performance as sound generators that interacted with the physical space.
And I'm very interested in moving back and forth between the mechanical domain, that which is inherently intuitive, and the electronic or computer domains where you very often end up, as I say, sharing responsibility, very often among multiple players, as I will mention. Some of it has to do with those noises one makes when one first picks up an instrument before one gains control, and figuring out a way to preserve that freshness over a longer period of time. Sharing responsibility between the player and the instrument, which is a very sort of 70s idea coming out of Tudor's Composers Inside Electronics. I should also say that all this stuff was born out of dire poverty. I began teaching 10 years ago. I was fortunate to have a long relationship with Stein that began at the end of the 80s. Before that time, I had no institutional support whatsoever, which will become painfully obvious when you look at some of the technology I've been forced to employ. Start with feedback. When I arrived at university, I discovered what everybody discovers sooner or later about feedback, which is it basically turns any object or room into an instrument. And in particular, if you do feedback inside an architectural space, you're basically overblowing the space as if you were to blow across the mouthpiece that is the doorway, and then you sort of lip it by, say, moving your mic around. In our studio at Wesleyan University, they had these very beautiful phase shifters by Carl Countryman, now known better for DI boxes. This was before the days of digital delays. This introduced very, very small time delays to a signal, very short. But what this did was if you changed the phase delay while connecting a mic to a speaker, it did the equivalent of moving the mic with respect to the loudspeaker because it was effectively delaying the transmission of sound, right? So this particular box, a gift from, well, I was born outside the cloth, and not a gift from God, a gift from countrymen, has an envelope follower on the input signal so that if you turn up one of these knobs, the delay would be adjusted by the actual loudness of the incoming signal. And that led to this construction where I have a microphone going through a limiter or compressor, which is what's keeping it sounding like a sine wave instead of going, as my daughter used to say, bistic. And then you have the delay and you have a little EQ to try to get rid of nasty frequencies. And what it means is that every time the feedback starts, the microphone is moved like a PA engineer with too much caffeine. You know, as soon as the feedback starts, you jerk the mic.
These experiments using feedback from microphones and loudspeakers in different rooms allowed Nicholas Collins to effectively play the resonant frequency of these rooms. The microphone-loudspeaker combination exposed or exploited the resonant frequencies of a room, because microphones placed in front of speakers will feed back at a certain level. This feedback was then limited or controlled to prevent major distortion, the sort of thing that happens sometimes in live concerts. And then, by phase shifting or slightly delaying the signal in time, Collins got a series of resonant sine waves that changed over time. And to make matters more interesting, this system reacted differently according to the dimensions and layout of the room, changing, for example, even if a breeze was introduced.
And if you set up two or three channels of this in a room, you get a very beautiful responsive environment where it's constantly self-playing the room, overblowing itself, and it can be influenced by any change in the acoustics of the room, by moving, playing a note, letting in a draft. And I think that what strikes me, even after the years, is that the sound itself is the responsive sensor. In other words, you're not changing the behavior of the sound by, say, influencing an ultrasonic field or doing motion tracking, but rather the very sound that is the performance is reflecting and filling and moving through the room. And when you move, you affect those transmission paths, right? So that by interfering with the flow of the sound you're hearing, you're in turn influencing the electronic system. So it had a very beautiful responsive property, and I always said it was like an architectural raga. Every room you were in, you would get a different tuning and a different behavior. In 2002, actually end of the 90s, I was asked to revive the piece by an ensemble. I was living in Berlin. I cloned the circuit as best I could. I actually asked Carl Countryman for the diagram. He faxed it to me saying, "This is on the condition you never ask me another question." Then 2 years later, his warehouse burned down, and I own the only copy of the schematic. So, Carl, if you need it, I still have it. My cloning it in circuitry was never perfect because he had one oddball component that was hard to find. So I did what everybody was doing in 1999 and 2000. They were recreating older circuit-based works in software. I used the ubiquitous Max MSP. I did three channels of it and added something that I always wanted. When you clone old pieces in software, there's a desire to improve and update. Bad idea, generally speaking. But what I did do was I introduced what I call the older brother filter, which is that in this piece, certain pitches of feedback become quite prevalent in a room, like having the older brother at the dining room table who does not shut up. And by hitting an X key on your keypad, a little notch filter moves in and whoosh, kills that frequency. You can actually kill 12 brothers in this. And what it means, ironically, is that if you let the performance go on as you keep lopping off the L-tern, you go from an inherently harmonic world to a disharmonic world, because what comes up then are the obscure resonances and irrational overtones of the room. So you can actually affect a harmonic movement, something I never thought I'd do. Work with feedback systems made me shift my attitude towards musical instruments and what we might call hollow objects in general. I sort of stopped thinking of them as things to play, as in a conduit for self-expression, and rather more as something to, and I know this is a tacky word, I can't think of another one, excite. You know, they always talk about exciting a resonator with energy. So I built a system for resonating guitar strings with sound. Initially, I did it backwards. This is what all avant-gardists do. I plugged an amp into the guitar pickups. Are you crazy? And then I picked up the vibration of the strings with that piezo disc that's up near the nut. And it was like an Ebo with an external input jack. And one could resonate the guitar. And then the guitarist was sort of had to use left-hand technique to manipulate the strings. But the right hand was sort of floating around and doing nothing. It caused some anxiety for some of them. And they would very often just press little controls connected to a computer that would channel different sounds into it. In a moment, you'll hear what that sound is like. But I should say that, of course, the great thing about guitars is one guitar nice, three guitars better. You know, you can have a band of beautiful young people. And for those of you who are fans of New York pop, this band later became the Band of Susans, one of the great noise guitar bands in New York. I gradually improved the tech. I originally acquired, at very low cost, what my wife described as those horny guitars from pawn shops, guitars with lots of prongs on them, which were always the cheapest. And I would do this backwards wiring. And then I learned very slowly how to make driver coils that moved the string with much more veracity. The band broke up. It was sort of co-opted. They had better things to do. And so I built the solo instrument on the armature of a Hawaiian guitar so that I could carry it with me more easily.
With this experiment, Nick explored the inherent possibilities within a standard musical instrument, but not as an object to be played traditionally, but rather as an object to be animated or excited, as he put it. He took an electric guitar and fed an amplifier's output into the guitar's magnetic pickups. This, in turn, was picked up by a contact microphone at the nut of the guitar neck, and the signal then fed back into the amplifier, thus creating a resonating feedback loop.
And now you're going to see how there's one driver coil over each string, and you'll hear the sound of gradually sending my speaking voice into one string at a time. So here I'm talking. And you hear it's a combination of sort of filtering and reverberation. Three strings, right? So it's just open. It's being played like a harp at the moment. So you sort of hear the nah-dale and four-dale in here, the advantages and disadvantages, that a lot of sustain, but here we go. Ah, we're in the real world. And what I liked about these instruments was you had issues of adjacency in the sound world that depended on there being mechanical contrivances. So you could get string buzz, you could get rattle, you could touch a string and it would break to a harmonic. You got an adjacency of acoustic phenomenon that was very difficult to simulate in software because it was completely separate routines. By difficult, I mean it took time.
His visit inaugurated a ceremony which was to be observed every morning so long as I stayed at the nursing home. Pulling his gold watch, it had Rococo Victorian initials engraved on the back. From his waistcoat pocket, he would hold it up to my ear. Can you hear the tick? Can you hear the tick? Can you hear the tick? I would shake my head. My head was thick with bandages. My father never failed to pay his early morning visit, only to administer the ritual of the watch. It gave me the first clue to the discovery I was to make in the course of the next few weeks, that I had completely lost my hearing.
I once did a tour with possibly the only other avant-garde music composer to use a Hawaiian guitar, Ed Osborne, and he was lamenting the fact that we had to carry these big planks of wood. And he's a Formula One race car fanatic, and he said we should be able to make a space frame chassis for our guitars. So I took the challenge. I went home, I got two levels from a DIY shop, and he said, build a space frame chassis, you can put all the electronics inside. So indeed, now instead of a suitcase and a laptop, I have just the laptop in a little suitcase. And so all the amps needed to drive, the strings are in there. The driver coils are on a sled now that you can move up and down the rails of the guitar to emphasize different partials of the harmonic series. There's pickups in the end. Of course, no guitarist worth his salt would ever make a sound like the previous track I played. Guitarists like distortion, and that's what's so nice about guitars. So this is oscillator sweeping through the strings with post-processing. It's louder, yeah? Louder's good. So, oh, here we go. This is nice. But for a long time, there were these guys with long hair and ebos, and there was me. I was alone in the wilderness, as is so often the case with me. So, yeah, I'm sorry. Now I have to shift gears to the really wacky one. Here we have an interesting juncture in my history. This box is a digital reverb, one of the last ones to be done before DSP-based digital reverb design. It actually used discrete TTL hardware to do digital signal processing. Sitting on top of it is a candy color red spray-painted Commodore 64.
Now, for those of you who aren't that old, the Commodore 64 was an 8-bit home computer introduced in the early 80s. It had all of 64 kilobytes of memory and sold in huge numbers, up to approximately 17 million units in its lifetime. Nick was also working with a Stargate, which was an early digital reverberation unit from the company Ursa Major. He used it to alter audio signals in real time in performance and then controlled the process from the Commodore 64.
And I had been using the reverb, hacking it in a way I will describe in a moment, controlling it from the Commodore and twiddling knobs. But once again, this is New York. This is the 80s. It was unbelievably unsexy. So I thought to myself, what I need, also I had a pedagogical drive, I need a very large knob, you know, like a huge slide fader to manipulate this thing so that people can see me on stage. It would be like the nerd's equivalent of a windmill, okay? And, you know, if nothing else, you grow up in New York, you inherit a lot of Borscht Belt humor. So I said, well, what is a large slide pot but a trombone, you know? So I actually had one lying around from doing my feedback manipulation in the old days. And I hooked it up to serve as a controller and more for the trombone. Just before we leave, here's a guy who designed the Ursa Major staring at me saying, you must be kidding. All right, so here's what I did. I took an optical shaft encoder, basically half a mouse, and I wrapped a retractable dog leash. Though, to be perfectly honest, when I went into the pet shop and asked for a small retractable dog leash, they said, we have a cat leash. And I thought, you must be joking, you troll with them? All right, so, and that was an incremental encoder like a mouse, all right? Then we have the movement of the slide. We have that little prong sticking out at the top is a Yamaha breath controller. There's a Fostex PA horn driver. I think it weighed 490 kilos. And then I have a keypad on the slide. And what I could do is I could click and drag to change any parameter of my computer program. So it was basically a huge mouse that you held on your shoulder. It actually gave me tendonitis at one point. The technology consisted of this Stargate reverb modified and a Bryston power amp. The PA horn driver actually required a lot of power. So that is a 50-watt power channel. And if you open up the Ursa Major, you will see the motherboard of a Commodore 64. Talk about the Stone Age of embedded computing. What I would do is I would take the lid off the Ursa Major. I'd hook up a monitor and a floppy disk drive, 8-inch floppies, and I would program in assembler code. And then when I had finished compiling code, I'd blast an EEPROM, and I'd put it in, I'd close it up, and I'd go on the road. If I take out the Commodore, you see the interface circuitry I added. At Ursa Major, they said, you will only stop when you run out of room. I said, I grew up in Manhattan. I know how to use space.
Listening to Into the Music on ABC Radio National. And this is music by Nicholas Collins, based on a fragment of Peruvian brass band music, which is the nuts and bolts for Nicholas's strange electronic manipulations. And his presentation is from the 2010 NIME conference, which stands for New Interfaces for Musical Expression. It was held at the University of Technology in Sydney.
I put parallel ports onto every chip of significance on that board, and the computer would either emulate the correct behavior of the chip, add, logical, gate, shift register, whatever, or I could confound that subsection of the machine code so that the shift register ran backwards or the counter subtracted. It was basically live sampling and signal processing. This was pre-laptop mobile computing. Mobile computing is hot this year, so I just thought I'd tap myself on the back for this one. The whole idea was, this was desktop Mac and PC days, Amigas, Commodores. You were standing there, sitting there behind the screen. I wanted to get out from behind the table and be able to work with a computer-based instrument that had the freedom to give me movement, okay? And this was a system that I never had to reference a monitor. I had just pure acoustic feedback from the click and drag. The other thing about this that was very nice was that I sort of glossed over this. There was a loudspeaker on the mouthpiece so that the whole instrument played back the electronic sound through the bell. And that meant that I had this loudspeaker that you could aim and move around and mute, and you could change the sound acoustically by moving the slide. Hey, it's a Foreman, right? So I'd worked with David Tudor for a long time. He used to say a loudspeaker is not a window for sound to come through. It's a musical instrument. Early 80s, I was hearing all of this early diffusion work, people saying, I want to move a sound. And I said, if you want to move a sound, move the damn speaker.
And as the loudspeaker was contained within the trombone body, Nicholas could move around the stage and so move the sound source, balancing the now very heavy trombone on his shoulder with the loudspeaker in the bell and his circuitry taped onto the body of the instrument. He was thus free to roam around and direct the sound wherever he wanted it to go.
I'm taking micro slices of Peruvian brass band music and running it through the Ursa Major. And then you'll see that that's acoustic filtering, just the movement of the slide. And then homage to Alvin Lucier's Vespers, no doubt. It was a very satisfying feeling of actually being able to bounce stuff off the room, like going into a haunted house with a flashlight. You can apply all the sort of post-processing that you would do if you were a brass player. So you've got half of the signal processing taking place in the digital domain, and half is very much in the acoustic. All right. I should mention that this was one of the first live sampling and signal processing instruments. I mean, live sampling is really quite ubiquitous at the moment, but at the time it was not an easy thing to do. You had to kind of build up your own systems. It was an inherently silent instrument. That is, it had no sound source built in. I was dependent on external sounds to process. It was my aesthetic, dare I say it, my religion at that time. And so whereas I created the instrument originally for this piece, and it was used for a couple of other composed works, it very quickly turned into a great instrument for improvisation. You end up on stage with this thing. It looks like a musical instrument, so people will let you play with them. And then the other players, you just grab their sound and process it. I was responsible for slowing down improvisation seriously in New York City because I'd grab a throwaway note and extend it for 2 minutes, and people would think, we're not getting anywhere. It had a friendly appeal. George Lewis said I was the first guy to bring a computer onto a bar stage. And this was the kind of stuff we did. The sound you're hearing is the late, great Tom Cora playing cello and me doing processing via that trombone instrument. The instrument did have a pair of line outputs in addition to the trombone speaker, so that if you wanted bass, you could send stuff to the PA. You could adjust the balance from the instrument. Thank you. All right. So, the instrument served me well. I kept opening it up, programming, sealing it back up, until I sort of, as I say, reached the limits of the physical dimensions of the thing and of my programming skills, packing more and more stuff into compact assembler code. I moved to Amsterdam in 1992 to take what I like to call my first real job as visiting artistic director of Stime, which was really wonderful in the one sense, but in the other sense, it was going in and out of the airport for a concert one day that the original trombone was run over by a taxi. So, yeah, well, you know, these things happen. So with the largesse of Stime, I built up Rev 2. Here we have the double rack space Ursa Major has been replaced by a single digital signal processor with a lot of MIDI hooks on it, because sitting underneath is the same lonely Bryston channel plus a Stime sensor lab that has been embedded into this. The trombone now used ultrasound, the lingua franca of Stime, to measure slide position, and it was now MIDI-based, as the sensor lab was MIDI-based, which gave me certain benefits. In this piece, one of the things I'm doing is using the slide to scratch through a drum kit on a MIDI drum machine, so that as I go like this, it hits different drums, right? This instrument also sort of ran out of steam at a certain amount of time. It got to the point that, again, there was a limited number of MIDI handles in the DSP box. There was a limited vocabulary in that device. Everything sounded very good at the beginning, and then it sounded too good by the end. It lacked some of the funkiness of the original. So I retired the instrument entirely and then brought it out for a gig, and it's like going to see an old girlfriend / boyfriend after 5 years. Bad idea. You know, and so I built up Rev 3, and this was with Sukandar Kartaninata's wonderful Gluon interface, which I know some of you are working with. You see the ultrasound sensor. The speaker, I love it. Makes it look like a small robot. It's the crystal ball speaker from an iMac. And for me, one of the great things that happened for this instrument over the years was that small diaphragm loudspeakers were now available with wide frequency response. So with this, I was actually getting something like a full range of response out of the instrument instead of it just being the sort of high-frequency PA horn character that I had in the earlier one. It was much lighter. It required much less power. I wrote the patch, of course. Obviously, this was my motivation, was start writing my own code with a few nice little additions. Most significantly, I have a routine where if there's no musician around who will play with me, I can scratch through my iTunes library, and it keeps the entire library running virtually in the background, so it always drops into wherever the tune is at that point. And it's kind of nice. It's Nick and his imaginary friends. Okay? And what did I gain? I lost, as I say, the cool funkiness of the original box, and there's some things that I'm just not a good enough programmer to emulate. But my back is much better. All I have now is a trombone. I still need the toilet plunger and a laptop and three channels of audio I.O., So it's very nice and compact.
Nicholas went on to explain the genesis of his work with the Princeton Laptop Orchestra, which he then adapted to become the Princeton Laptop Marching Band.
Once I joined the academic mob, if you can call art school academic, all sorts of doors opened to me. And when I had my first sabbatical, I was invited to be a visiting fellow in the music department at Princeton University. And I was invited to do a piece for the Princeton Laptop Orchestra. I didn't really know why they were sitting on stage hooked up to these speakers. I thought the whole purpose of laptops was to walk around. So I did a piece for the Princeton Laptop Marching Band, where it could be Princeton Laptop Unplugged Marching Band, but I didn't think of that when I did my slide yesterday. Each player, their internal mic and their speaker are feeding back at insanely high gains and self-ducking. And then there's a sound file of clicks and pops from cylinder recordings that triggers the effect. And they wander around like this, and every time they hit the space bar, it randomizes parameters, and their screen is just a single color. It's monochrome. So it also randomizes the color, so they get this very cool, like, bad rock show, bright purple screen or green or yellow. Midwinter, some of those colors are very hard on one's complexion. So it's nice. It looks a little bit like the monks in the Holy Grail when they walk around this way. And it's a really ratty-sounding piece because I don't have cool gloves or anything. That's just coming out of little speakers that are being overdriven like crazy. But if it's one thing we learn from guitars, it's overdrive. It brings me to one of my last points here, ensemble instruments. Working with the laptop orchestra, you know, I was always being made aware of how few electronic ensembles there are. And when I was a student, Alvin Lussier introduced me to Christian Wolff's work in 1972, and it just blew my doors off. And when I started to do work with logic circuitry and computers, I looked at pieces like this, and I said, this is like proto-computer music, right? So I did circuit-based pieces and later computer-based pieces that were designed to coordinate players' actions on various simple interfaces. So in 1978, I bought my first laptop, great machine, 1K of RAM, expandable to 4, but you know the story. So I went over to this, and I did a couple pieces. This works with the same idea of coordinating players' actions on two keyboards, and whenever they come into sync, something changes. By the way, the method used for sound generation in this is shift register output, long pulse trains, and adjusting the distribution of pulses. It was really difficult to get D to A converters in those days, so we did a lot of very odd, basically PWM-based stuff. And I then, as a result of my work with hacking workshops, got quite interested in masked circuit-based performance. And I did this piece that was an attempt to keep a few dead circuit boards out of the landfill at Guiyu in China. It's essentially six oscillators. Each one has in its feedback network two probes. I did a piece where you put the circuit down, you get six people to try to reanimate it by connecting their probes to whatever they thought was appropriate on the circuit board. And it comes out like this. So there is performer number one. See, she does not know what she is doing, and yet she is making beautiful music. And here comes number two. It's a bolero, what can I say? Number three. And I mentioned earlier this idea of post-Cajun angst, and this is a lovely example of an instrument that, by having six people, 12 hands playing this, I get these sound results that I can't conceive of, much less produce. And I've tried to do it. I've tried to make, you know, like the Freddy Krueger glove so that I can do this all with my own hands, and it just never sounds the same. I mean, people are great. They work independently, you know? Anyone who's ever tried to have a band knows that, right? They work independently. This was a very nice feature. We're going a little backwards here. I started out in circuitry and then moved into computers as a way to work with things, but always kept sort of one foot in circuitry. I like things that are interconnected physically. When I started teaching, my students discovered this and wanted me to teach a course in kind of low-level electronics, and I kind of developed this thing in hardware hacking that led to pieces like that circuit piece salvage. And it also led me to, you know, figure out simple ways of manipulating sound in ways that are, say, difficult to do with a computer. And we use a lot of photoresistors because they're cheap, they're wide range, and they're very intuitive to work with. Then, of course, if you start working with a light sensor, you have to start thinking about, well, how do I perform with light? So candle flames are rather wonderful because they have such multidimensional variation to them. So I came up with this piece. Now, I was told I should do this live, so let's see what we can do. Yeah, okay, so.
The piece we're listening to, In Memoriam, Michelle Vizevich, is constructed using a small circuit board, a 9-volt battery and a birthday cake candle, which was burning brightly. The flickering of the candle stimulates 4 light sensors that control the pitch of 4 oscillators, which go in and out of tune as the candle flickers. The sound that we hear is determined by the movement of the flame. Nicholas set this up in the auditorium at the University of Technology and projected the image of the flame flickering on the large screen. It was a great end to a fascinating talk.
Dang, I did it. All right, that's it, folks. And I actually get to say, any questions? That's the question? Okay, the question is, how is working with electronics intuitive? And I think maybe I didn't make myself clear. I don't know that working with circuitry as a designer is any more intuitive than, say, programming software or sawing wood. I think what I meant was that when you work with analog electronics, you very often end up having a much stronger connection to the physical, mechanical world. And I feel that the mechanical world is intuitive to us just because we've been falling over since an early age. You know, there are things like gravity and force and pressure that are part and parcel of our physiological makeup by the time we're old enough to make independent decisions about what we want to do. Introduce people to circuitry through like a workshop or something, I try to keep stuff very simple. I try to keep it like old-fashioned Lego, you know, with just a few bricks that you can combine permutationally. But is that any different than teaching someone to use software? I don't think so. At the end of the day, there may be some sort of primal kinesthetic thing about working with your hands on circuits. It's like knitting. You know, that it stimulates endorphins or something, you know, that pressure. Worry beads, rosary beads, knitting, soldering. They may be all in the same category.
The next question from the audience was about how the actual building of instruments ties in with creativity and whether the making of the instrument itself is part of the musician's expression and offers them greater creativity.
Boy, that's a really good question because I see a lot of bad instrument maker music. I don't think that making a beautiful instrument inherently makes you a great player of it. And sometimes the least intriguing instruments have turned out to be the most productive musically and vice versa. My concertina on paper was brilliant. It had everything. And it sucked as a performing instrument. I just never managed to get anything real happening with it. So I think you can go both ways. I'm sorry to give a wimpy answer, but I think NIME conferences, it's a perfect case in point. You see great papers and not so great papers, and you see great performances and not so great performances, and it's very difficult to correlate.
The whole notion of how electronic interfaces differ from instruments, and in turn what signifies a compositional process, came up next. It's a question that's at the heart of Nicholas Collins' work over the last 40-odd years.
The question was, how does the interface, the instrument, and the composition of the compositional methodology, how do these various elements differ from one another or interrelate? And I can't remember now, I have such bad short-term memory and long-term, that whether I said this at the beginning, but one aspect of working outside of any institution in the 70s and 80s in particular was there was no such thing in my life or the life of my colleagues as pure research. None of us had the luxury to say, oh, I think I might like to develop a pressure sensor today, or I might like to work on ways of curving the Yamaha breath sensor to be more expressive. No, we only did research and development that was targeted towards a specific outcome. In my case, it was always targeted towards a compositional outcome. And as I had what, in my weird world, I would have called a compositional idea in mind when I did it, and everything was feeding into that. It was only with the trombone instrument that opened up, and the instrument kind of went away from being mapped to a specific work, and it became a general improvising tool. And this was a great revelation for me, because until then, I think maybe you could say I never designed an instrument. I only designed like a 3D score or something. Right, because they were so, in my own mind, they were so tied to a very specific way of working. And that is just part and parcel of my personality and way of working at the moment. Other people may have a very different approach. But, for example, even today, I very seldom sit down and approach an abstract issue of, say, interface design without thinking about a target. I'm not a bright guy. I have a limited number of brain cells to spend on this stuff, and so I keep it focused.
The last question related to the piece Salvage and the use of a circuit board by a number of students and whether they could, in fact, short-circuit the whole thing and blow it up.
No, actually, they're short-circuiting constantly. What's happening is that the routes that are made between these probes, you have no control over where they are. So, in fact, a lot of these oscillators are working in a disallowed state, which is that you have outputs shorted to inputs and outputs shorted together. And it's just the nature of the driving circuitry. It doesn't care. The circuit is dead and not plugged in. It is not plugged into power. It's a passive circuit. That's one of the reasons why you get such odd sounds, is there are active components on those boards, whatever they are. You know, they're computer chips, they're I.O. chips, there's all sorts of things that normally operate with power. They are being operated without power. So their circuit topology, is it a capacitor, is it a resistor, is it an inductor, is completely framitzed. I mean, we're operating in the nether zone. I think we probably have to end, don't we? Dang, it's exactly 10 o'clock.